The opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that, professional opinions and a layperson's opinion about the case of Dylan Farrow and her allegations of sexual abuse by her father, Woody Allen. Woody Allen has denied any claims of wrongdoing and has never been charged or convicted of a crime. Furthermore, this series will contain graphic discussions about child sexual abuse and coercive control. Listener discretion is advised. If you or someone you know is a victim of child sexual abuse or coercive control, please don't suffer in silence. You're not alone. There are specialist organisations and trained professionals who can help you wherever you live, such as Stop It Now or RAIN or the Domestic Abuse Hotline in America or the NSPCC or the Domestic Violence Helpline in the United Kingdom or 1800 Respect, the Blue Knot Foundation or Bravehearts in Australia. And so, with that having been said, lovely listeners, here's our latest episode discussing and deconstructing the case.
The adopted son of filmmaker Woody Allen is defending his father against accusations Allen sexually assaulted his adopted daughter nearly three decades ago. In a lengthy blog post yesterday, Moses Farrow said he can no longer stay silent as his father, quote, continues to be condemned for a crime he did not commit. Moses' younger sister, Dylan Farrow, claims Allen sexually assaulted her when she was seven. Allen has always denied that. Bianca Golodriga shows us Moses' new accusations against his mother. Bianca, good morning.
Good morning. Some detailed accusations at that. Moses Farrow claims his adoptive mother, Mia Farrow, raised her children by coaching, influencing, and rehearsing. He says his father never assaulted his sister, Dylan Farrow, and suggests the story was likely planted in Dylan's head.
He has no morals.
That's Moses Farrow in 1992, publicly denouncing his father, Woody Allen. But in a post on his blog Wednesday, Moses describes that moment as the biggest regret of his life. Moses claims he endured years of mental and physical abuse at the hands of his mother, Mia Farrow, and that led to him being obedient and deeply afraid of her.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer, producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and host of Crime Analyst.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and we're jumping right back into the case of Dylan Farrow.
I know we had questions from listeners about Moses.
Yeah. You know,
why would he kind of waffle? Why would he go back and forth? And ambivalence within a family where there's accusations of incest. It's very typical that other siblings are on the fence, and sometimes they're on one side, sometimes they're on the other side, where they are developmentally, where they are in their relationships, where they are in their lives. All those things can weigh in. And we just have to take Moses' behavior at face value. It is what it is at this time. He's allowed to say what he wants and act the way he wants. Just let him be. But
yeah.
it's just totally normal to have incredibly strong ambivalent feelings. And just so you know how I'm using the word, it's that they have strong feelings on both sides of the issue.
Right.
And so this is what his behavior is evincing.
And I think for some of our listeners, they're conflating two separate things. You know, when I watch those home movies of Moses as a little boy, I mean, he's just so adorable and you just want to hug him and take care of him. And to see him now as an adult, he's got many, many videos on YouTube that you can watch where he's disclosing his own, what he's saying is physical and emotional abuse by Mia. To me, he seems very believable in those recollections and he seems completely traumatized. And those may be true, but those are a separate issue. And one thing that Moses does say in those videos is that when he would be punished for something, Mia would try to get him to have a repetition exercise saying to say he's sorry for doing something. And that she would try to make him say that over and over. And so he's sort of trying to connect that to perhaps Dylan was coached in the same way. And as we've already said in our previous episodes, that's not at all what Dylan is describing. She's not doing some kind of acting repetition, side coaching performance. No. It's just really different. But I just want, my heart goes out to him. You know, what can you say? I remember my mom coming after me when I was little with a wooden spoon because she thought I'd done something wrong. And you know, she had moments of explosive temper, but she was also a fantastic mother. And this had nothing to do with me when she had these moments that she lost control. I mean, does it cross the line into child abuse? And does that mean that Mia is a horrible parent? I mean, that's just not for me to judge because...
Well, it was for the court to judge, actually.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think we have to remember that there was a court case and there was a child custody trial, which was in-depth and detailed. And the judge heard and saw no evidence of those behaviours. So we hear later on in life, Sun Yi and Moses both make allegations about Mia Farrow. And in fact, Sun Yi spoke out and said certain things that when she was little, that Mia, they were like oil and water. They didn't get on at all. Well, there's other accounts that say differently. And there's other written documents from Mia Farrow saying how she adored Sun Yi and tried to do everything she could and was so proud of her and that she made her a better person and a better mom. But Sun Yi said that when she picked her up from the orphanage and she went and had the first bath in a hotel, that Mia just plonked her in the water. And she says that that's abuse because before at the orphanage, she would always be with other children in a bath and she had never been in a bath on her own and was fearful. But Mia gave no regard to that.
Well,
so the question is that...
Known.
Is that abuse or is that Mia not understanding her background, her context? So as you recounted, Lisa, we all have these moments in our childhood. But what I do see is that there's congruence between Sun Yi, Moses coming out later on saying that Mia Farrow abused them, but the child custody case and the judge saw no evidence of that. They said that the judge actually said that she was a very caring mother. And there's lots of other testimony that says that, too. And we can't conflate it with Dylan's allegations because no one was there at the time. So I do take issue with Moses with certain claims that he said that, you know, there was no train, for example, and we heard seven people support the fact there was a train in the attic. So sometimes you might not remember well. And other times when you're saying things later on, he certainly can't say that Dylan didn't have that experience either. Because that was her congruent and consistent testimony over many, many years. So I think we have to be careful not to play one off against the other, which is what it feels to me, that one should cancel the other out, and it doesn't.
Yeah, another thing that we should mention is this contemporaneous disclosure is very rare in children, and it actually does indicate veracity. In other words, it's not something that takes away from it. It actually, the fact that there's almost immediate outcry and outcry in detail and then repetitious outcry, all that stuff is self-confirming. I noticed that one of the listeners said that I think Sun Yi was groomed as a teen, young adult. However, they stayed together. Is that typical of a victim of grooming would stay so long and never break out of the control? Does that just mean she is compliant and he hasn't felt the need to replace her? Well, you bring up the notion of compliant victimization, and grooming is the tool through which offenders get access, authority, and control over children. And it is a very important and effective means. But there's also grooming the family, and there's also grooming society. And we've seen indicators of all of that. And it's not unusual for somebody who is what we call pillar of the community offenders to be able to groom the entire society against the victims, because most people in society believe that anybody who sexually victimizes a child has to be a monster predator. And when they see somebody who's nerdy and quirky and goofy and just incredibly famous and wealthy and successful, and they've also been fans of his movies, which sell this May-December relationship, which is actually more like December-January relationship, you know, that basically what you're talking about is somebody who has the ability to groom and manipulate the entire population, not just the victims. And so I think that's all kind of connected.
Yeah, I think there was also an allegation that was made. I just want to make mention of this, that Sun Yi said that Mia was obsessed with Satchel Ronan, and that she wanted to breastfeed him until he was 7 or 8, and that she would lock herself in the bedroom with him. And, you know, again, this has come up much later in life, and it just seems like there's some kind of mirroring going on in these allegations. You know, the judge and others have also said other members of the family, they saw no favoritism within the family and how it was made up. And yet Sun Yi was asked, could she think of one positive childhood experience? And she said, no, not one. And again, I find that very strange, because actually in my experience, even when there is abuse, the child or even the adult will still recount things where things were wonderful and there was love and they want it to be that all the time. Yeah, and it is that ambivalence you spoke about, and it's being conflicted. But Sun Yi is very black and white in her answers. And I'm talking about the Vulture interview in 2018 when she speaks for the first time, that I do see a number of things that I would want to follow up on and ask more questions about. And that was one of them, saying she couldn't think of one positive childhood experience and the things that she said about Mia. That's her opinion. She's entitled to her opinion, of course. I wasn't there, but it does seem to be in direct contrast, particularly with the documentarian said that they are specifically each child, now an adult in the family. They were looking for things on either side. It wasn't going in with a single lens, but they didn't find any evidence of favoritism or the adopted children being treated any differently. But 40-year-old Moses Farrow did say that Mia's mothering style, he said that there was a total breakdown of your spirit to ensure that you would do what she wanted you to do. It's the honeymoon when you're first adopted, then the veil gets pulled back and you start to see Mia for who she is. It's in direct contrast to everything else that has been reported about her. And we have to remember, she didn't want to speak out. She wasn't the one driving to get any form of publicity. So each child has their own opinion of childhood. In my family, it's the same. You have one event that happens, three of you have very different perspectives of it.
Right.
Yeah, it's a whole and that Rashomon. Happens too. Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I was just thinking about this. This whole case has brought up a lot of memories for me. But I remember my little boy was about 3, and he had broken out of my grasp and was about to run across the street. He thought it was a game. He thought it was so funny. And I leapt. I mean, it was like I was superhuman, and I grabbed him by the back of his shirt just before he ran into a car, and I yanked him back, and I didn't care. I had his hair, you know, in my hands, and I yanked him back, and I was just like, don't ever do that again. And then afterwards, I thought for sure that I just, you know, traumatized him, and he has no memory of that. Right. Yet there's this other time that he's like, mommy, don't you remember you were yelling at me about something? I have absolutely no memory. And that's what it's like when you're parenting.
It doesn't work. Right. And I was going to say earlier when you were talking, Laura, that, you know, every relationship, every especially long-term familial relationship is filled with roller coaster rides. I mean, it's not exact same thing. People actually grow and relationships change over time. And, you know, the dynamics of children who are being protected by a parent can experience that as being overwhelmed by a parent or abused by a parent. But the fact is that the child developmentally doesn't understand what the adult is doing. Mm-hmm. And which is why when adults abuse children, take advantage of the fact that children aren't developmentally abled enough at this point, that's such a horrible thing. But when a parent is actually legitimately parenting a child, many times that can be misinterpreted by the child. And that's just normal. Because, you know, my mother used to say the parable about the child who went away to college thinking his parents were so stupid. But then after 4 years of education away, they came back and realized how much their parents had learned in the last 4 years. And of course, what it is the perspective of the child is skewed. The parents didn't learn anything new. The child grew and matured and realized that what the parents were saying all along was actually the right thing. And I think that's something we have to take into account when you're interviewing adults about how they experienced their childhood. Your memory is not a digital recording of what happened. It's filtered through your personality, and it's filtered through age. And every time you remember something, you can actually alter that memory. So you have to take this with a grain of salt. And that's why when allegations come up, you have to look for corroboration. And there's some internal corroboration, and there's some external corroboration. And as you said a few times, Laura, the judge who looked at all of this found no evidence that Mia was being abusive to her children and found a lot of credibility in Dylan's allegations against Woody and believed that Dylan needed to be protected from him. That says so much.
It really does. Woody Allen's audiobook, of course, we hear throughout the documentary, which are in his own words, which again is very important. We're hearing things in his own words and out of his mouth. He said that Mia Farrow was all about smearing him. That was her goal. When, of course, we don't see any evidence of that. She actually shies away from saying anything at any point. I think there's the Vanity Fair article, which, again, I still find extraordinary that they would only publish it if she was prepared to give evidence in court if they got sued. And she said that she would. And that was the only reason it got published. But she wasn't the one picking up the phone, you know, getting people to run stories, etc. But yet, that's the classic Darvo to me, when someone turns and flips the script and then it's been said. And then I hear Sun Yi, well, I read in the Vulture interview, which again, I highly recommend people read it because it's in her own words through a reporter, but she says that she believed Mia Farrow was taking advantage of the Me Too movement. And again, what I heard through the documentary was that Mia had said to the documentarian straight away, I'm not going to be interviewed. I will support my daughter, but I don't want to be interviewed. And she made it very clear that she didn't want to have a voice. The only reason she spoke out was to support Dylan. Mm-hmm. It's far easier to stay silent, actually, in one respect. And that's what she tried to do. She just wanted peace and quiet. She didn't want all of this. But yet, isn't it interesting that, you know, Woody Allen and Sun Yi both have the same opinion? Well, they've been married for 20-odd years now, haven't they, for a long time. Is that surprising that they both share a similar opinion and they both look to blame Mia Farrow when it wasn't her who made the allegations in the first place?
Yeah. They were asked to be part of this documentary. They did not want to participate, and that's their choice. Yeah. But
I can't remember what the tributes were to Woody Allen on TV, because to me that seemed to be the tipping point, that Dylan was watching the tributes to Woody Allen.
Yeah, like a Lifetime Achievement Award that Diane Keaton.
Yeah, the Lifetime. Was that the Oscars or something?
I think it was the Oscars, since he was getting an award. And then Ronan tweeted about it, like, I forget, some very cryptic tweet. And then Dylan felt the urge to tell her story, which they couldn't even get printed until Nicholas Kristof allowed it to be part of his editorial. So, I mean, wow. That's who's controlling the media. Yeah. That's a very interesting thing to ask.
Yeah. Well, Woody has been a media darling up until this whole incident.
Mia wanted Sun Yi to have a Korean sibling. Fletcher loved his new brother, Moses, who had cerebral palsy. Over the years, Mia provided him expert therapy, and he thrived.
Uh-huh. How old are you now?
5.
How does it feel?
Good.
Anything you want to say?
Yes.
Okay.
Dad, I love you.
I love you.
Mia didn't think any man would be interested in a single mother with many children, but then she became involved with the renowned filmmaker Woody Allen. Frank and Andre were open and passionate, but Woody had a quiet charm that was irresistible.
He called me one day. I'd been sick, and he told me that he loved me. And I loved him too. And I really needed him and looked forward to seeing him, and it was a great light in my life.
Although Woody had been married twice, he had never been a parent. Every day he came to visit Mia and her children.
You wouldn't look at those people and think, oh, well, this is Mia and her kids and then this guy. I mean, they were a family. And I guess he never understood that because the boundaries he crossed were monstrous.
One of the questions from our listeners said, do you think the fact that Farrow and Allen maintained separate homes and never lived together during their relationship could have been due to Farrow's subconscious knowing something was wrong? My answer is no. I believe it was driven 100% by Woody Allen. He's the one that wanted to maintain separate residences. I don't think Mia wanted that. I think she felt she was the lesser powerful component in this relationship. He was the more powerful one. He's the one that made decisions.
He's there every single day, every morning, every night. He's there constantly. I don't know, Jim, for me, just living in New York, that just didn't seem weird to me that they had two apartments. I don't know why. I mean, who's going to give up their apartment?
You're right. Yeah. Keeping two apartments is normal, but not living in two apartments. If he had stayed with her every night, or they went back and forth between places. But no, that's not what happened. He came to her place on a regular basis. She didn't come to his place with the family on a regular basis.
Maybe not. I think sometimes they were there. I think there is.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. But no, they didn't have their own rooms there and stuff like that.
Right.
But they're just across the park from each other. I mean, it's.
I know, it's but just it's like a so world apart. It's not like having a room down the hall. And I think that he did it on purpose to maintain his privacy because he had other nefarious things in mind. Mm. That's what I think.
Sure.
One listener asked for a breakdown of the various types of offenders and criminal classifications. That would be helpful. I believe it would be helpful, but that would be a 10-hour series. So I'll just tell you to go to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children website, ncmic.org. And look up Child Molesters, A Behavioral Analysis by Ken Lanning. And you can download this 160 or 220 page report that goes into all the details about this. And the fact is that where Woody Allen falls on the spectrum or the continuum is something that we would have to do a separate full analysis on before we could classify him, and we'd need more information, most likely. But in that Child Molesters Behavioral Analysis, you'll see information about incestuous offenders. You will also see information about father figure offenders, and you can read that and educate yourself about that so that you can be better able to protect kids in your life.
And remembering that child sexual abuse is pervasive and 9 out of 10 children know the abuser and it's somebody that they trust and a third are family members. So this isn't rare. This isn't an anomaly. And that's why, again, just to say, I'm really glad that the docuseries came out. I'm really glad we're having this difficult conversation because too often it's shied away from. And we also know that 1 in 4 girls throughout their lifetime are abused, 1 in 6 boys and men, but only 0.01 are false allegations. So again, putting it in its context, you know, why is it in a family court that 98% of children who make allegations of abuse are not being believed right now? 98%.
This is outrageous.
It's an inversion of reality.
Right. There's no statistical basis for that kind of belief. And I've said this before, and I believe the numbers are probably more equal with boys and girls being sexually victimized, because the majority of the offenders are male, and the victimization of a male child by a male adult has added impetus for the child not to disclose, on top of all the other pressures and guilt and societal judging that happens with all children who disclose. So I believe that they're more equal in terms of the numbers of victimization across both genders. But the fact is that when you have a situation where a child comes forward and discloses, there's very little that society does to help them if they don't believe them. If they don't believe children are disclosing truthfully, then how are we helping children? How are we protecting them?
Well, not just that, Jim. The court's likely to award custody to the abuser. That's why that context is really important that professionals understand. I've trained lots of court reporters and people who work in the family courts, and most of them don't have this level of training. But it is absolutely shocking that 98% of children who allege abuse are not believed in a family court, but yet the statistics tell us otherwise. That is staggering. That tells us judges need training. All court staff need training. And I know lots of professionals listen to our podcast. So there are so many training points and learning points in this that are so important, particularly about parental alienation. And I would ask all professionals to think about that very carefully, because it is spreading still like wildfire. And it is a junk science. There is no evidence to support it or to back it up. And why do we just believe a male psychiatrist without any peer-reviewed articles, all just self-published? How can that happen? So we do need to professionally be more curious, ask more questions. And as what happened with Paul Williams, always trust your instinct and ensure that you're on the right side of things, quite frankly. Because I could imagine for him as a professional, that was pretty scary, you know, being one of the top investigators to then being fired and being demonized and vilified. I think that takes a lot for someone to go back to that job after they've treated him so badly. And who was it? I'm still curious about who was it behind the scenes, who was making those decisions and why? Why were they making those decisions? We talked about a little bit about, well, with that New Haven Yale report, why would Dr. John Leventhal make those decisions? Was there money, you know, being exchanged? What was happening in the background? And Amy Herdy does talk about that actually in an interview that she did. And she said she did look to see whether there was any money changing hands. She didn't see any evidence of that, but she did say that all the professionals said, and I quote, careers were at stake.
Right. That's one thing I think we forgot to mention. And if you haven't seen the documentary, Paul Williams says that he was in contact with one of the social workers who are listed on that report in the Yale New Haven and who had examined Dylan and found her credible.
Right.
That is such a smoking gun, isn't it? And why was, I believe her name was Jennifer Sawyer, I believe. Why wasn't she ever subpoenaed or... why didn't they get her deposition? I mean, she seems like the key to everything. And I know the other woman had passed away, but yeah.
Yeah, because the prosecutor had made the decision not to go ahead and make that arrest.
Well, we know that at the custody trial that it was John Leventhal who was deposed, but none of the others, and the wording I had was cooperated. But was it the fact they didn't cooperate, or were they told in no uncertain terms, because this has happened to me in my workplace, and I won't go into the details here because it's too long a story, where you're moved off and away from something and somebody else takes your place and they're the ones who are the mouthpiece.
Yeah.
And that to me seemed very strategic, because I think that is very important, Lisa, that that's what he found. But it must have been a very scary place for him. You know, who were pulling these strings? That shows the power. And of course, in episode, I think it's the last episode of the podcast, actually, we hear Amy Herdy talking about how she was being followed. She was under surveillance.
Yeah.
And people, they were actually over in her face, taking pictures and, you know, documenting her in the supermarkets. And she was asked, well, why do you think they're doing it? And of course, they're trying to find dirt on her to discredit her. Well, whose payroll is that on, I wonder?
It's a good question, Laura. A really good question.
But it's scary and it's chilling. It chills people from coming forward. It chills people from doing this kind of investigative work. And it can even chill a podcast from wanting to talk about it, you know?
Keeps people silent. So when you hear that careers were at stake, well, we saw evidence. Look what happened to Paul Williams. Mm-hmm. He was fired. So it wasn't just rumor mill. You actually saw it happening. Mm-hmm. It happened to one of the top investigators. If it can happen to him, and I've seen it throughout my career too, I've had similar experiences. Maybe one day we'll get into that, but it's not unusual. And it talks to power play. And a lot of times professionals don't want to talk about that. You don't want to raise your head above the parapet because it gets blown off, quite frankly, and you get discredited. And that's probably what they're looking at for Amy Herdy. But as she said, they're just fine to buying a lot of spinach. which I thought was quite funny.
Right.
But it's still scary. I mean, you're being followed, it's being documented. You don't know. There's an unpredictability about it. You're uncovering all these things. You're going on record. It's menacing and it's intrusive. And of course, we know that that was done to Mia Farrow too, the intrusion and the investigators. And we know that happened with Weinstein, Bill Cosby. There's lots of powerful men who've been accused of things where allegations, multiple allegations have been made. And next thing we hear, there's intrusive investigations. And again, the Davo, the table's being turned. So it's frightening when it happens. And this isn't just entertainment. This is people's lives that are being torn apart and threatened and careers and livelihoods.
Right. And when you threaten somebody's career and livelihood, many times they just have to withdraw to protect themselves. And, you know, I think Williams was brave standing up to them and he suffered the consequences, but that was rectified. He was reinstated and it was clear that he was doing the right thing. But at that point, it was just too late to continue the case.
On Sunday, Alec Baldwin continued to defend and battle director Woody Allen, who has been accused of sexual abuse by adopted daughter Dylan Farrow. Baldwin has previously called her allegations unfair and sad. On Sunday, he took it a step further and compared Dylan Farrow to Maelle Yule, the character in the classic novel To Kill a Mockingbird, who falsely accuses an African-American man of rape. The actor tweeted, "One of the most effective things Dylan Farrow has in her arsenal is the persistence of emotion. Like Maelle in To Kill a Mockingbird, her tears and exhortations are meant to shame you into belief in her story. But I need more than that before I destroy someone, regardless of their fame. I need a lot more." Baldwin followed that post with this: "To say that Dylan Farrow is telling the truth is to say that brother Moses Farrow is lying. Which of Mia's kids got the honesty gene and which did not?" In addition, he shared a Sunday New York Times piece that discussed whether Allen would work in the business again. Baldwin concluded with, "If my defense of Woody Allen offends you, it's real simple. Unfollow, condemn, move on." Dylan Farrow responded to Baldwin's comments with a statement to The Hollywood Reporter on Sunday. It's interesting that Mr. Baldwin chooses to dismiss the judgments of Justice Wilk and Prosecutor Frank Mako, who reviewed all of the evidence instead of just selected bits and pieces, she said in her statement. However, considering that Mr. Baldwin confidently invoked Maelle Yule to make his point while forgetting that it's been hotly debated that she was, in fact, raped by her father, demonstrates that perhaps Baldwin is just not a stickler for details. Moses Farrow claims the abuse allegations are false. Allen has always maintained his innocence and said the story of abuse was planted in Dylan's mind by Mia Farrow. In a series of tweets posted Tuesday, Baldwin praised the director and also cast doubt on Dylan Farrow's allegations, writing, "Woody Allen was investigated forensically by two states, New York and Connecticut, and no charges were filed. The renunciation of him and his work no doubt has some purpose, but it's unfair and sad to me. I worked with Woody Allen three times and it was one of the privileges of my career." The actor previously stated that, in his opinion, sexual abuse complaints should never be dismissed, but he says accusations should also be treated carefully. Baldwin tweeted, "Is it possible to support survivors of pedophilia and sexual assault and abuse and also believe that Woody Allen is innocent? I think so. The intention is not to dismiss or ignore such complaints, but accusing people of such crimes should be treated carefully on behalf of the victims as well."
And people get blinded. We heard in episode 4, Alec Baldwin, Diane Keaton defending Woody Allen. "Well, he gave me my first break," as if that means that they can't do the things that have been alleged. That doesn't mean to say that they're a good person necessarily. So we have to remember people's personal agendas in things. That doesn't mean to say someone's innocent.
Right. And it's important. I mean, and this may sound crazy coming out of my mouth, but just because you're a good person doesn't mean that you're not also sexually interested in children or sexually victimizing children.
Yeah.
People are not just unidimensional. They can have multiple different dimensions going on. They can actually be loving fathers, loving mothers, loving aunts, loving uncles, loving brothers and sisters.
Good teachers, good counselors, good religious leaders.
And still find themselves sexually attracted to children. Now, that doesn't mean that all of them act on that, but some of them do. Some of them are just very adept at grooming not only the children that are targeted as victims, but their parents and guardians and society as a whole. And so we, as adults in this society, have an obligation to help protect children. And one of the best ways you can do that is to actually educate yourself about what actual offenders are like. And that's child molesters, a behavioral analysis. It's a great resource. Please rely on it. There's also books like Gavin De Becker's Protecting the Gift and Child Lures by Kenneth Wooden and A Well-Armored Child by Joel Castaix. And all those are good resources that you should rely on. And please join us. Help us help protect kids.
When children are abused, the trust bond is interrupted. And not every child, well, children will behave differently. But if you do see behavior that is maybe concerning, it might be someone's being very introverted. It might be they're being too loud. It might be they're being too sexualized or whatever it might be. You should be asking more questions about that. And it's a very confusing and scary place for a child, I think, when you are so conflicted by the person that you love who's doing things to you that feel bad. That's the only way you can articulate it, feel bad, and you might not have the vocabulary for it. So for professionals, for mums, for dads, I say that whilst I'm stroking my 23-week pregnant tummy, thinking about, you know, who and how you bring a child into the world and just all the things that can happen, you know, is believing a child when they do speak out and asking more questions about what's going on and supporting them. And depending on the age of the child, holding space for them and giving them a safe place to be able to talk to you in a non-judgmental way. And as you, Lisa, and Jim both spoke to, not reacting in a way that you're shocked or horrified or showing any form of emotion, just being able to hold space and listen to what's being said, mm-hmm. and then making a decision about who needs to know about what's going on, because it is a child protection and safeguarding matter. And there is mandatory reporting. And we do have to think about that child's safety and welfare, but also if it's happening to one, it might be happening to others. So that's a very important thing. I think a lot of people don't really know what to do or what to say if you do get a disclosure. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know if you want to say anything more about that, Jim.
Well, the best thing to do is to reach out for psychological help for the child. And that psychologist is going to be a mandated reporter. And if that person evaluates the child and believes that they have been victimized, they have to report it. Parents can also call the police directly, and they can call child services directly. And I'm always of the opinion that you should report, because I want to protect not only the child that discloses, but the children down the road who might be victimized if the disclosure doesn't happen.
You can also understand a parent might be just so overwhelmed, like, do I really want to call? I don't really know what happened. I'm not sure if I want to call a big agency or a service. So it sounds like going to a counselor right away, going to a professional from one of these organizations, talking to somebody right away so that you can get help and in evaluating what the disclosure really means. Would you say, Jim? And it's a little bit more personal and maybe feels more private than calling the police, because you don't really know what you're interpreting.
I know, but the police are the ones that can investigate that. So
can they? I mean, will they?
I know I did it. I know Laura did it. I know hundreds of other people who did it for their careers, and they're very dedicated. Yeah, there are some that aren't qualified. Mm-hmm. There are a vast number of people who are, and if you don't want to go directly to the police, there are child advocacy centers in almost every city across the country now. And that's a good place to go. But there are professionals, and I would rely on the professionals to do the investigation rather than a parent who doesn't know, one, how to investigate, or two, the niceties, the nuances of investigating a child sex crime. If a child alleges sexual victimization, I believe it should be investigated by professionals, period. leaving it to non-professionals or school authorities or
university campuses.
Yeah, there you go. It's just not appropriate.
Yeah.
It's just not.
And I agree with that. And there are lots of trauma experts. The other thing I'd say is if you're talking to an advocate, ensure they're trauma informed, but knowing that there's life after abuse, it doesn't define you. It's not who you are. And we're all testament and testimony to that. Healing is not a linear process, though, but there is life after abuse and many go on to do incredible things. So know that you're not alone, or if you're a parent or somebody who's heard a loved one who has been abused and you're struggling to deal with it, there's also help and support for you too. But I think that's probably a good place to end on. Mm-hmm. I've certainly, you know, found the series very compelling and the investigation very compelling of new things that I felt I should have known, but I learned for the first time. And the podcast really did give more depth to the investigation of hearing voices and hearing from friends and family members who lived through it. Some of them don't appear in the documentary, the docuseries, because there was just too much material and content. So probably a very difficult decision to decide what goes in there. But I'm glad that HBO commissioned it. I think it is a very important contribution to understanding what happened, and certainly hearing Judge Wilkes' statements from him in particular that really do make clear what happened. And it's not just about speculation and opinion. There was a court, and those in it heard testimony, who had all the evidence. So it's not just about wildly speculating that Woody Allen did something or not. Dylan was seen as needing protection from him. And that speaks volumes to me.
It's been distressing covering this docuseries and the case of Dylan Farrow. And I hope that Dylan understands how much good she has done by coming forward and being assertive and being very detailed about what happened and driving this docuseries and podcast, because it has educated countless millions of people across this country and around the world. And that's a tremendous benefit to people who survived sexual victimization and to children who otherwise would be victimized. But now there are smarter people out there who know some of the ways in which children and parents and guardians and society is groomed. Thank you, Dylan.
Yes, amazing. And it can't have been easy. And she's now a mother.
That's right.
A little girl, I believe it is, isn't it? So,
awesome.
Yes, I mean, incredible, really, for Mia and her to share what went on. It's not easy for anybody to say what happened, but also for it to be consumed by the world and then to opine and make judgments about whether you're lying or whether you're not. So I would ask people to seek out the facts and the evidence rather than just wildly speculating. So I'm really pleased that this docuseries happened. We're hopefully going to be talking to Dr. Joan Meyer. So if you have any questions, please do keep them coming, as there are so many areas that we could really dive into, you know, also with coercive control and domestic abuse. And again, if you're suffering, please don't suffer in silence. There's help out there for you. Please do report it. Please do use the domestic violence hotline and domestic abuse hotline, both in the US, UK, and there's also resources in Australia as well. And we'll be talking about Gardner and parental alienation, which I know from many of my colleagues, as well as from survivors and victims. They're just so relieved, I think is the right word, that finally a spotlight is being placed on that. And Jess Hill has just released her documentary in Australia. And again, it's being consumed at quite a rate, I have to say. Her book, See What You Made Me Do, and I haven't seen the docuseries yet, but I plan on watching it. It's exactly the right time for everyone to understand parental alienation, all these things that you might think are strange concepts or theories, but in the real world, real life application, it's hugely problematic and destroys lives and means that children are still continuing to be victimized and adult victims of domestic violence. So we have to get better at understanding and challenging You know, don't be afraid to ask questions and to challenge things pro-socially. Just because someone's a doctor or a psychiatrist, it doesn't mean to say they're right on everything that they are positing. Many have never been trained in child sexual victimization or coercive control or stalking, and yet they make all these sorts of determinations that can have such a negative consequence in whether it's a criminal justice setting or the family court setting. And a Real Crime Profile, we've nudged into the family courts a number of times. And I've always said what goes on in there is very, very frightening because, again, it's been shrouded in secrecy where for the first time we're now having these conversations and there's a spotlight being placed equally on the psychiatrists who've come up with these theories without right. any practical evidence base to support them.
And it's pretty obvious that they're meant to help engender a system that allows sexual victimization of children and violence in the family. And it's just unbelievable.
So if you're listening to this and if you've watched the docuseries and podcast, please engage in some self-care, look after yourself, reach out for support. If you need help, we will have the helplines at the start of each of our episodes and also on our website, and know that you're not alone.
Well, thank you, Jim and Laura, for your expertise. Thank you for holding my hand through this process and dealing with my rapidly escalating and waning emotions.
Thank you for being so open with us about everything.
Thank you all for listening. Thank you for your questions. And for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203-866-4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.